On today's episode of Battleground Yorkshire, I am in the Tory seat of York Outer to see how the suburbs and villages around the city will vote at the next election. I'll be chatting to Conservative MP Julian Sturdy and his Labour challenger to hear what voters are saying on the doorstep. And our big issue of the week, what do women want from the main parties? I'll be speaking to Dr. Mary-Ann Stevenson from the Women's Budget Group to find out just that. Hello and welcome to Pod's Own Country, the politics podcast from the Yorkshire Post. I'm your host, Mason Boycott Owen, the paper's Westminster correspondent. And this, of course, is Battleground Yorkshire, our new election series. I'm covering 12 Yorkshire constituencies in 12 weeks and speaking to voters, candidates and experts to get you the story behind the polls. So, to kick us off, our first seat, we are in York Outer, the area surrounding the North Yorkshire city. It has historically been a Tory seat through and through, and has been won by the Conservatives in every year since it was established in 2010. But all of this was before Labour established the mighty poll lead that it currently enjoys. Being some 20 points ahead in the polls means that a seat like this should be won at a fairly respectable canter by Labour at the next election. So, is there hope? Well, I caught up with Julian Sturdy, who has held this seat since its inception. Julian, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Morning, morning from Westminster.
Let's kick off with housing. This is something that obviously has had a bit of a checkered history in York.
I think, look, provision of housing is a massive issue across the country. And yes, it's a big impact. It does have a big impact on York and in York Outer. The big impact for York has always been the fact we haven't been able to secure a local plan since the 1960s. We're very close to doing that now. It's out for consultation. There's a final inspection in March and later this month, and we're hoping, you know, we'll get over those final hurdles and we'll have a local plan in place, which that local plan then delivers the housing that York as a city requires, but at the same time also protects the Greenbelt and reaffirms the Greenbelt, which is a big issue for my constituency because York Outer, the ring around the city of York, contains all that Greenbelt land. So we have to deliver more housing, and the local plan will do that. It is a really important issue for the city. But whenever you're delivering more housing, and I think this is where successive governments have failed, is that, and we've seen this in York, you know over the 70s, 80s, 90s, when more housing has been built, there hasn't been the infrastructure that is gone with that new housing, and that's one of the sort of the big issues that we're facing in York, the fact that the transport infrastructure is struggling. You know, thankfully we now got the money to dual the Northern Ring Road, got funding for a new station in Haxby, new rail station at Haxby. All these issues, as well as, you know, important issues like, you know, better drainage, that needs to be because of, you know, the issues over flooding. And surface water flooding, which some of my communities are affected by, and also local services such as new GP practices and things like that. They all have to be factored in to making sure that when you're getting new development, that you get those services at the same time. And that's where the local plan is so key to delivering that.
And looking forward to the next election, obviously you're up against Luke Charters again. You've beaten him before. Can you do it again, or is it going to be more difficult this time around?
Well, I think it'd be foolish if I didn't say it was going to be a tougher contest than last time. But yeah, no, absolutely. I think it is going to be a much tougher contest. I mean, a number of different Labour candidates. Some have been, you know, leaders of the council, or two leaders of the council that stood against me in previous elections. So, you know, you don't really focus on the candidate. You focus on what you can do and what the party is doing, and that's what it's all about. That's what it's, you know, it has to be about, and it's what we're delivering at a local level that you know I really need to highlight as my local MP. As I said, you know, at the beginning, you know, we've got the money to dual the York Outer Ring Road, something I campaigned on back in 2010 when I was first elected. And we've actually now got the money. We've got the money. We're seeing the work starting and we've got the money to do it. And I remember being told at the time by loads of people, oh, you'll never get this done. This will never happen. It's been talked about for 30, 40 years and no one's ever done it. And now we're actually seeing it happen. Haxby Station, another classic example. I remember having meetings 2 years in as an MP and we were talking about it, held a big community meeting about it, about how we could get, you know, Haxby Station back on the agenda. It was there in the 1930s, hasn't been there since. It was closed in the 1930s. Big sort of support for the community to get it back open again. We eventually now are seeing that happen. So it's about, you know, actually getting action in the constituency. And these things do take time, obviously. You're not going to be able to move things in 2 or 3 years. But actually, you know, I've got to stand on my record. And the fact is, you know, we were told numerous times that we couldn't do these things. And we've delivered them. So I'm proud of that. And I think that's what, you know, I've got to stand on and talk about.
And for these undecided voters, obviously people have their issues with the Conservatives, but a lot of people are not quite convinced just yet about the Labour Party. What can you and your party say to these people to make sure they don't make that jump?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important issue, is this? And obviously, you know, I'm out knocking on doors, we're talking to people all the time, as we are all through the year, not just at election times. But obviously, when you're talking to people now, on the doorstep, there is a lot of undecided people out there, a lot of people who, frankly, are quite, you know, annoyed with what's happened with the government, with the Conservative Party, but at the same time are not committed to the Labour Party, have not made that switch. So for me, the real positive in that is, I'm going to be honest with you, after everything that has happened with the government over the last few years, if they haven't switched to Labour now, then I think, you know, there's a real chance we can win them back. That's the first thing I would say. So that's me being, you know, the positive element, me being a positive person, to say that we, you know, they're, you know, if they haven't gone now, then we've got a real chance of winning them back. But the big thing, obviously, on the doorstep is also, you know, then they're not convinced by Keir Starmer. So he has not won them over. There is a definite, you know, element of that coming through loud and clear. But it goes back to what I said earlier, you know, we've got to, you know, it's not, this election isn't going to be won by, we don't like Keir Starmer, you know, or, you know, for us, it's going to be won by what we can do, what we can do now over these next few months to convince people that, you know, the economy has started to turn around, things are looking better. And after we've made some very difficult decisions, but they're now starting to pay off.
I guess also what we come back to again and again is, you know, the size of that Labour poll lead. Obviously, in a seat like yours, you know, you'll be out and about speaking to voters. Do you see that replicated out on the doorstep?
Well, on that point, I'd say on the doorstep, what I'd say is that, you know, there's certainly an element where, you know, it doesn't feel on the doorstep like what the national polls are telling us, if I'm honest. And I suppose that is based on the fact that when you do national polls, they take undecided people are taken out of the equation, aren't they? And they only take the people who are committed to either voting, you know, Conservative or Labour or the other parties. So I suppose that's why, honest opinion, I feel the polls are probably slightly, you know, inaccurate at the moment. But that's not being me being complacent at all, because what that tells you is that there's a huge group of undecided people who've, you know, probably, you know, a lot of those undecided have been Conservative voters in the past that are now unsure about how they're going to vote. And that's why I still strongly believe that, you know, this election is still very much up for grabs. It's not a done deal, despite what the national media might be trying to tell us and portray. That's not how it feels on the doorstep at all. And we've still got, as a party, a huge amount of work to do to try and win those voters back over. But as I say, the positive element for that to me is that they, after everything that, you know, honestly, we probably have put them through over the last 18 months, then, you know, they still haven't committed to voting Labour. So, you know, that means there's, you know, we we can still win. You know, I think there's a lot of those voters that we can still win back, but we're going to have to work damn hard to do that.
Julian Sturdy there, clearly under no illusions that this is going to be a tough fight. A decent Labour majority at the next election relies on winning places like York Outer by quite a margin. Despite a decent showing by the Liberal Democrats locally in council elections, they have not finished second in the seat since 2010, with Labour looking as best placed to take the seat while the Lib Dems struggle to make much headway in the national polls. And for the people of this seat, Luke Charters is a familiar name on their ballot papers. The Labour candidate ran previously in 2017, securing a 12-point increase on the party's previous outing. And now, he's back for another bite at the apple. Luke, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, thanks for having me.
So, how are things different this time around? What's changed to make this seat more winnable for Labour?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I look around York Outer and I'm out speaking to families all the time. I've been a candidate nearly 2 years, and actually it's families moving perhaps from the city centre out into some of the suburbs and York's outer villages. It's really changed, and actually it's a lot of young urban professionals there, and it's a lot of people who are also in their sort of early retirement that are really struggling. They're struggling to access those services. I think it's some of these reasons that the seat is looking more positive, as well as some of the sort of new housing developments that have come on board. So I think there has been quite a lot of change in York Outer that means it is more winnable for us this time.
And what about housing? Is that a big issue that you're trying to address in the seat?
I think so. And I think my colleague Rachel Maskell does a lot of work on holiday lets and short-term Airbnbs and so on. And actually in York, there are thousands, I think over 2,000 Airbnbs. And
yeah.
I think that is a huge phenomenon that's probably driving families out.
Yeah.
And, you know, York's a beautiful place to live. It's a magnet for families. And that's what's driving this pressure on the housing market. And, you know, of course, with the new housing developments on the outer parts of York, we've seen that shift. So, you know, most conversations seem to be more and more with families, but again, it's people wanting that nice place to retire. But it's the anxieties now of accessing public services in York Outer, GPs closing and so on, that's just making living in York Outer more and more challenging for all generations.
And what's Labour's solution to this? What's the party trying to do on housing, you know, in this seat and in other ones across the country?
Well, on a national level, of course, we want to build 1.5 million homes in the next parliament. And we want to reform planning, but we want to do so with the consent of the local communities. If I look in York, there are some quite interesting schemes that look like garden villages where the public infrastructure is put in place by the developer. They will build a health centre, they will build a local primary school. And to me, housing developments with that infrastructure underneath feels a much more sensible solution. I do get nervous about some of York's villages where public infrastructure is already so stretched. And I think the solution in York is looking at housing developments where there is that public service infrastructure underpinning those new projects. And that's what I want to see. And those are the kind of projects I'd be championing this year if I'm elected.
And this building, this housing revolution, is that going to be taking place on Greenbelt land?
I think you've got to be pragmatic about it. There's different definitions of Greenbelt, different parts of the land there that you could look at. But we've got to build more houses. And, you know, as I say, I'm renting in the York area. I looked around 10 properties myself. It was incredibly difficult to find somewhere to take my dog and my young family with a little toddler. And absolutely, we need to build more houses with local consent in accordance with the local plan, where the developers and where there's a contribution to the infrastructure as well. So I think there are sites around York Outer that I'm quite interested in, such as there's a Clifton Gate garden village, which looks quite interesting if the infrastructure's there. So I think there are some limited opportunities, but that's the mature political leadership we need to get more people on the housing ladder. And it certainly can't be saying no to every single housing project that comes online.
And turning to the doorstep now, is it a sense that people are more pro-Labour or are they just anti-Conservative at the moment?
I genuinely think it's a mix of both. I mean, I was a candidate here in 2017, and it is such a stark difference. You know, from things I've been invited in for cuppers and people driving past, beeping their horns. It's a really warm atmosphere for us out there. You know, from the villages to the suburbs, our votes are going up. More and more families are interested in our messaging. But as you mentioned, at the same time, more and more families are turning away from the Conservatives, and many we've seen actually going to Reform. Many are not going to bother to vote. And I think the local factors do make a difference. They see that in York County we've got an invisible Conservative MP and very little set of achievements in his 14 long years as MP for York County. And as myself, being a local dad, brought up here, that's resonating with people, because I think people forget you vote for a name, you vote for a constituency MP in this country, and so many families want to make that choice as well this time around.
And in terms of how Keir Starmer goes down on the doorstep, I'm told again and again by Conservative MPs that one of the reasons they're so hopeful about the next election is that Keir doesn't sell well on the doorstep. Do you think that's how you feel?
There's a lot of respect for Keir on the doors I meet. Everyone will recognise that he's an immensely trustworthy, credible individual. And look, I've been a parliamentary candidate for 2 years. In that time, I've had a baby boy, and I know that Keir's a family man, and he's wished me well. And I think he's absolutely the sort of Prime Minister we need for this country. The way he's changed the Labour Party around, such that we are now the contenders to win York Outer, I think it's testament to the change that he's going to deliver this country. So the people I meet in York Outer, actually more and more as the weeks and months go on in this campaign, they are increasingly raising Keir's attributes as the positive change that we need after 14 long years of Tory decline.
Well, there you have it. Optimism from both Labour and the Conservatives, with a long time to go until polling day. Now, turning to our spotlight issue of the week, the data wizards at the Yorkshire Post have crunched the numbers for this seat and revealed that it is estimated to have the highest proportion of women of any constituency in the region. For listeners of last week's podcast, you will know that women are key for the main parties. Research suggests that the high proportion of slightly older voters from suburban towns who voted Tory in 2019, the much-coveted Whitby woman, are undecided and can be won over at the next election. But what is highest on the priority list of women voters? Does it differ significantly from men? And why do successive governments seem to ignore them when shaping their policies? Earlier I spoke to Dr. Mary-Ann Stevenson, the director of the Women's Budget Group think tank, to find out exactly that. Dr. Stevenson, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
When we talk about women voters, do they differ that much from the way that men vote?
So we did some polling on this last year. And what you find is the two most important issues for women are the same as the two most important issues for men, which is the NHS and the cost of living, not surprisingly at the moment. Interestingly, men are more likely to talk about the economy. Women are more likely to talk about the cost of living. You know, whether those two are the same thing, whether when people talk about the economy, they mean the cost of living, it is not clear. But there are other issues that men are more likely to raise than women. So, for example, immigration and defence are more likely to come up as significant issues for men than they are for women, and women are more likely to say that the NHS and healthcare is the most important issue for them. So, for example, in the UK as a whole, 64% of women compared to 48% of men gave the NHS and healthcare as one of the three most important issues facing the country. So it was a top issue for both men and women, but more women were likely to raise it.
And if you were advising the main parties on how to target women voters, what kind of things would you say are the main things that you should focus on?
I mean, I think the first thing I point out is women are much more likely to say that they're floating voters or they don't know how they're going to vote than men. So last year, one in four, 25% of women said they were uncertain about who they were going to vote for at the next election, compared to 11% of men. Now, that might be because we know there is men have a tendency in polls to not like saying, I don't know. Women are more likely to say, I don't know, generally, in answer to questions. That might be just more willingness to admit uncertainty rather than actually being more uncertain, if that makes sense. But it does mean that, you know, there's a big chunk of women's votes that are up for grabs. And obviously, women are not a homogenous group, right? Different groups of women will have different priorities. But I think it's also important to recognise that women are differently situated in the economy and society. So things to do with care, like childcare, social care, are more likely to come up as priorities for women than they are for men. And also, as you said, rooting your appeal to voters in the day-to-day rather than in the abstract. It's not that, you know, men can talk in abstractions and that women can't. But that, for example, again, if you look at the polls, women are more likely to talk in terms of cost of living and men are more likely to talk in terms of the economy as a whole. So talking in practical terms about policies that will benefit them and their families and their communities makes a big difference. And recognising that for women, unpaid care has a significant impact on their lives. You know, women do 60% more unpaid work than men. Most of that is care work, which leaves less time for paid work, which is why women, you know, why we have a pay gap, why we have an earnings gap, why we have a pensions gap, why women are more likely to be poor, more likely to depend on social security, less likely to benefit from tax cuts, more likely to be affected by cuts to spending on local services, for example, both because they're more likely to work in local services, they're more likely to need local services, and they're more likely to be the ones that have to pick up the slack when local services disappear. So, you know, if there isn't social care available, it's more likely to be a woman who leaves work in order to look after a parent or a parent-in-law than her husband.
And how much progress have we made in closing that gap for women in politics? Because it feels sometimes as if it doesn't get the same level of attention that it did just a few years ago.
In 1997, for example, we had all the focus on Worcester Woman and, you know, the need to win women's votes. And to an extent, you know, that came from the Labour Party, who were aware that historically women had been more likely to vote Conservative than men. That's actually changed. Women are more likely in the UK, are more likely to vote Labour than men, and less likely to vote Conservative overall. But it's not just a gender gap, it's a gender generation gap, because while younger women are particularly more likely to vote Labour than younger men, older women are more likely to vote Conservative than older men. So you've got that kind of switch, but the age at which that switch happens has steadily gone up. So it's now into your 60s before women are more likely to vote Conservative than Labour, which is obviously bad news for the Conservative Party, and you know, something that they really need to look at. I mean, look, as I said before, women aren't a homogenous group. There's all sorts of different issues, and how what people vote on and what they prioritise will depend on, you know, their situation, where they live, and all of those sorts of things. But women do often have a different experience of the same issue to men. So, for example, you know, both men and women might be concerned about local public transport, but women use transport differently to men. Women make different types of journeys to men. Men's transport needs are often more about commuting in and out of work, whereas women tend to do what's called trip chaining. So they will take the kids to school, then go to work, then come back via the supermarket, drop off some shopping at their mum's, check she's all right, then go home. That's much harder to do. Our public transport system isn't set up to facilitate those sorts of trips. So unless you have that sort of analysis, it's very easy for policymakers, and, you know, decision making is still very male dominated. So we still have the idea of the male as a default and the women as slightly unusual, slightly different, rather than recognising that women are actually more than half the population. So, you know, economic policy, policy about getting people into work is often focused around men's jobs and men's working patterns rather than around women's jobs and women's working patterns. You know, we've seen if you have a large factory, for example, that largely employs men closes down, it's often a very major news story. If you look at what's happened with the decline of the high street, for example, where shops are closing all over the place, those are mainly women's jobs that have disappeared. And they're often replaced by jobs in warehouses as people move to shopping online. Warehouse jobs are more likely to be taken by men. But that doesn't attract the same amount of attention as, for example, a single large factory closing. And that's partly because, I mean, obviously a single thing is easier to focus on than a number of smaller things across the country. But it's also, I think, because at some level we think of men's employment as more important than women's employment. And even though we know that, you know, most families can't survive without two earners, you know, it's difficult to afford rent or a mortgage on a single income, there's still a sort of residual idea that women's jobs are a little bit about pin money. They're sort of nice to have. They're not fundamental to keeping food on the table and a roof over your head.
And is a female chancellor going to do anything to change that, do you think?
You would hope so, wouldn't you? I mean, I think yes. Having more women in politics is kind of necessary but not sufficient to get a focus on the issues that affect women. I think, you know, there's lots of things that can be symbolically important while at the same time not necessarily having the impact that you would hope on policy. But, you know, I think we need more women in politics because I think women are more than half the population and should be fairly represented. I also want policies that reflect the needs of women. I don't think one should be dependent on the other.
So in terms of it's an interesting point in terms of you know, it's there's a difference between having women in positions of power and having people in positions of power who enact policies that help women. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think so. And I think you need both. I do think that you know, we've had a dramatic increase in the number of women in Parliament, for example, since 1997. I mean, Labour's policy of all women shortlists made a huge difference to the representation of women in the Labour Party. And that in turn pushed the Conservatives to take action. They didn't use all women shortlists, but they did use, you know, sort of lists of high flyers who were then parachuted into to safe seats. And a significant number of those were women. So they took a different form of positive action, basically. And that has made a difference to some of the issues that you hear discussed. I mean, when I first started working on these issues at the Fawcett Society, actually, in the mid-1990s, and the idea that childcare would be the centre point of a budget speech from a chancellor would have been laughed at. I mean, in actual fact, when Harriet Harman tried to raise the issue of childcare in the 1980s in Westminster, people did actually laugh at her. You know, you can watch the footage or hear the recordings, probably when it was on radio rather than television. Issues like violence against women, for example, which were seen as marginal. You know, there is now a recognition that one in four women experience domestic violence and abuse. That's not, you know, that's not a small number of women. All of us will know somebody, will have a friend or a family member who has been in an abusive relationship, even if we're not aware of it. Similarly, sexual violence. And I think having more women in Parliament has pushed some of those issues up the agenda and it has made a difference. But we've still got further to go.
That's all for this week's episode. If you want to find out more about the battle for York Outer, then subscribe to the Yorkshire Post for more analysis and insight this weekend. Next week, I will be in the safe Labour seat of Barnsley South, where I will be exploring the reasons why ill health has become so entrenched in Yorkshire and how experts think we can solve the crisis. See you then.